Observations. It's Scott Kirk and Craig here. And hello, fellas.
Good morning.
Yeah, good. Yeah, afternoon on our side. I want to just have a quick update so people kind of know where we're at before we return to what I think are the two most important chapters of observations for our time. We're in chapters 10 and 11 of Volume 1. I think that even though I'm now writing chapter 21, I think what I'm likely to do is to call through chapter 11, volume 1, and begin volume 2 with chapter 12 of what is now Observations for Our Time. Just on a personal note, so that people know, I was really writing chapters at a pretty brisk rate there for a while. I've slowed down here in the last 2 weeks, and part of that is that I've had suffered a fairly significant knee issue that has made it more difficult for me just to sit in one place or to get around, even walking around. I'm going to have surgery here in a little over 2 weeks on it. And there's a lot of therapy kinds of things I'm doing to try to keep it under control between now and then. And there'll be some therapy after it. So I'm going to be a little sluggish here because it is pretty painful and I'm not smart enough to just not to do the things I've normally done. For the previous 3 days, I actually dealt with some of the snow because we got 6 inches of snow here just so they can get in and out of the house and hurt the knee and even hurt my back trying to deal with this shoveling snow with the not being able to move the normally way I would. Normally you'd bend at the knees to lift things up, but I can't do that, so I bend at the waist and then hurt my back. So I'm only sharing that for two reasons. One is for those who have become accustomed to me getting a chapter out now about every 2 weeks. I'm even less than 2 weeks, and I'm slower now. That's a part of the reason for that. And I want to emphasize something for all those who listen to these programs. Just because I'm a member of the Covenant, and so are many of you, if not all of you, who are listening, does not mean that that I expect Yahweh to deal with physical ailments. That is not his job. As a matter of fact, if the moment we think that that is his job, that as a loving father he should want to care for his children, not have them suffer any pain, and the moment we project onto him like that, we're being religious.
Mm-hmm.
And we just ought not do that. I never asked, and God never offered, from the moment that I began these projects, to live a pain-free, disease-free life. Now, I did not expect that every investment that I made would pay dividends, and I would have no encounters with idiots. I did not expect, in fact, expected just the opposite. I expected to be slandered,
mm-hmm.
not to be praised for this work, and that's really what happens. And it is God's responsibility, and it's appropriate for him to do this. There's so few people who are willing to stand up and convey his message, knowing that it is extraordinarily hostile to religion and politics of all kind, and militarism, patriotism, that you know that you're going to create lots of enemies. That was the situation with Doe David. I mean, the moment that he began to convey Yahweh's message in his psalms, he manufactured countless enemies. Well, that is the nature of what we do. And there are so few people willing to do it. It is in God's interest, in his business, to protect those who do it. Now, protecting them does not mean that he's going to keep me from hurting my knee. But it does mean that if someone who is political, patriotic, or religious takes offense at Yahweh's message as I'm conveying it, that they will not have access to me or to my home or to my family. That's the kind of protection that is really required of those who are engaged in conveying Yahweh's message. And he protects us in that way. We have a promise, 91st Psalm. But beyond that, the moment God were to say, well, because I really love old Kirk. Kirk is just, he's just the nicest guy in the world. And because of my affinity for him, I'm going to make certain that he never has a single pain. never has, never makes a mistake.
Really?
Never runs into anybody who's critical of him. Every relationship he's engaged in will be uplifting and nurturing because I already love him. And everything's just going to be perfect for him between now and the time that I bring him home. So, you know, first of all, there'd be nothing to look forward to because life would already be perfect for you, Kirk, right here and now, as opposed to later. He's going to have to, of course, intervene and change the laws of nature. Laws of thermodynamics will no longer apply to Kirk.
Create, you know.
Right. I'm assuming that to make all that work, too, he's going to have to do the same thing for Terry. I mean, yeah, you know, Kirk needs a perfect wife to go with the perfect Terry, with the perfect Kirk. So, you know, all of that would have to transpire. And then, of course, you'd be dealing with the thing that, wow, if it's, he's doing that for Kirk, I want that too. And how many people would you have that become part of the covenant because they want riches?
Well, the land would form.
It was the interesting thing. I'm not a fan of Solomon, and I've made that very clear.
Yeah.
There's nothing that Solomon said or did, with one exception, that impresses me. Don't like the guy. I can't. Don't like. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, probably true. I don't like the guy. That's okay. You know, I don't have to love everybody as part of the covenant. Solomon's not my favorite. And maybe, you know, when I meet him in person, I'll change my view. But right now, he's my least favorite. And the one thing that he did that was right when, you know, Yahweh asked him, so what do you want? I'll grant you what you want. What do you want? And, you know, he said, what I want is wisdom. I want understanding. I want the ability to read and to observe and then think and form conclusions that are reasonable, rational, and discern insights maybe that others would not otherwise see. I want wisdom, understanding, the capacity to comprehend. And Yahweh was thrilled. That's because that's the one thing, most of all, he wants to give his children. If you're willing to be observant, if you're willing to read his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, you're to think about the things that he has conveyed, he will do everything in his power, even to cause people who have no earthly qualifications like me, or that, you know, are artists, not linguists like Kirk,
yep,
to come to know him and to form all sorts of profound insights about his nature. He'll give you that. In fact, he even said to Solomon, because you've asked for that, I'm going to give you everything else. But had he asked for riches, for health, for a long life, victory over his enemies, that sort of thing, God would have said, yeah, too bad. You asked for the wrong thing. Just too damn bad for you. Sorry, but that's the human response. So God is not trying to give us victory over our enemies. It's not his role.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want wisdom, no problem. But the other things, that's just not his affair. And it just should be known.
Mm-hmm.
And
was blind. He went blind. I mean, all these people had terrible things, a lot of terrible things,
mm-hmm,
just because of old age. I mean, my God.
Yeah. Yes.
You can't stop the old age machine.
No. That's one of the reasons why I constantly say this, you know, Islamic and Christian notion of a bodily, a body in heaven is just stupid. I mean, every aspect of religion is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to imagine any aspect of religion more stupid than wanting a physical body in paradise. They deteriorate. They're a liability. And if you had one, you couldn't be immortal, and you'd never be able to explore the universe with the rest of us. You'd be stuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be like light if you're going to get anywhere, do anything, live any length of time. So it's important to know those things. And what I wanted to do is to resume where we were. We had done a quick review of the preamble to Yahweh's meeting with Abram. Begins on Bereshith, Genesis, in the beginning, 11:26. And I want to start there, and we're going to go through two chapters of material. I'm going to share everything that I am aware can be learned regarding the covenant discussion that Yahweh had with Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
From the introduction, actually the preamble to the introduction, to the final test that Yahweh conducted of Abraham to validate his participation in the covenant. God is doing, well, we really learned this with some of the social network groups, the Facebook groups that set up around this program, where a lot of people became fully capable of parroting phrases and then intermixing them with all manner of lies and inappropriate behaviors, all claiming to be covenant. And yeah, I was very much aware of that. And as such, he does have a test. And if you can't pass that test, you aren't part of his family. And it's appropriate. I'm glad he has a test. And I'm glad that Abraham passed the test and that Yahweh, it's an open book test. And Yahweh gave us, these are the qualifications that you must meet to pass this test. And we're going to go all the way through, from the preamble of the first introduction all the way through the completion and the passage of that test, because there is nothing more important. And try as you might, there is nothing more important than knowing how to become part of the covenant, knowing what God is offering and what he's expecting from us. If you can think of something more important than that, then we'll spend the next, 3 months shows on that.
Just reading it this week, it's been it's been thrilling. I mean, there's very few times when I've been as excited to read something, even though I'd read it a long time ago. And studied it a long time ago. I've never found anything quite as good. For some reason, it's resonated with me this week more than anything in a long time.
Yeah, in fact,
not that the other stuff wasn't great. I mean, yeah. I'm just going, so comforting, so thrilling. I mean,
yeah.
It really gets up.
I think what you had said when you were reading through 10 and 11 is that it's just all so straightforward.
Yes. I'm having trouble. I'm not having much trouble translating most of the stuff. There's some key words where I'm going really deep to flesh out everything I could to make sure there's no contradiction in context or otherwise. And he's very plain. You couldn't be communicating better. I know we're in English and this is Hebrew, but you couldn't make it any simpler so that anyone could understand if they have an open mind. If you gotta jettison all that religious stuff,
correct.
Just open your mind, and there it is.
Correct. Yeah, it's a lot more fun these chapters, for example, than the chapter that I'm working on now, which is Yahshua 14, which could well be the single darkest chapter in the whole of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
Well, there are dark days ahead. It's pretty.
Yeah. Well, it's not just because there are dark days ahead. It's sad because this is the presentation of Satan as he is.
Yeah.
And man's proclivity to align with him. So, and it's important for us to know who the enemy is.
Yeah.
And how the enemy engages in religion and politics, and why Yahweh is not going to allow any of that stuff into his home. And I had a friend write me today and say that he presented the covenant story to some friends of theirs who were in a religious community. And while they had come to question their religion, and while they're angry at God because they lost a child, their response was, the reason they wouldn't even consider it is that it would take from them this hope of seeing, of knowing that their child is in heaven, and of seeing that child again someday.
Well, if it's a lie, how does it benefit from that? If you can just
well, it's not, and of course, and not if it's a lie. Since it is a lie, why would you cling to it?
So yeah, it's
but that's
irrational.
But all of Christianity is a lie. All of Islam is a lie. All of Judaism is a lie. Well, why do people cling to these lies? Is feeling good about being deceived a rational behavior?
No. It's kind of like a mental issue.
Yeah. All right, so this is the beginning. It says, and Terach. Terach means the living embodiment of the two messages of Teruah, proclaiming the joyous news of God's beneficial healing while rebuking man's fraudulent treachery and deceit. Lived, Chaya, stayed alive. 70, the satisfying promise of 7 years, and he fathered Abram. And following that, Nahor and Haran. Nacor means one who snores. We'll find out that might sound, well, that's pretty funny to name a kid one who snores, but it's a reason the kid is named Nacor. And yeah. What comatose represents.
Yeah.
And right, and Heron, the high and mighty whose fortress is overthrown, pulled down, and destroyed. Do you think there's a reason that God bothered to tell us that Terach, who we're never going to meet?
No.
That Terach was 70 when he fathered Abraham?
Well, it sets the tone, doesn't it? It's special. The seven bursts. No. I'd have to stretch it a little bit. Tell me what you think.
Well, the reason that we're told that Terach was 70 when he fathered Abraham is that Yahweh's plan plays out over 7,000 years. There are seven steps that we follow as members of the covenant, through the doorway of Pesach, across the cleansing, welcoming mat of matzah that perfects us, to be embraced as his children on Bukurim, to be enriched and empowered on Shavua, to proclaim the overall message to all who will listen on Teruah, leading to the reconciliation of Yahweh with his children, Yisrael and Yahudah, so that we can all camp out with Yahweh on the seventh day. That's the message. Everything follows that formula. That's why the earth was created over 6 days, and the seventh Yahweh rested. That's why a week is 6 days long, leading to the seventh, which is the day of rest, the Shabbat. Everything that Yahweh conveys is conveyed as seven. Or 70, or 700, or of 7,000. And so he's telling you
everything
that...
Everything is in Abraham. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. So Terach...
I was looking for, yeah, okay.
Terach lived for 70 years before he fathered Abraham.
Yeah.
The reason that's important is because the entire plan unfolds over...
Or 6...
Seven, yeah, over 7 days, 7,000 years. Depending if you're talking about the invitations to meet with Yahweh, or you're talking about the days of creation, or you're talking about the human timeline experience, it's all seven. No, it'll be exactly 7,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden to the time that Yahweh will end the experiments with this first universe. And it'll be six of those days will be the days of mankind. The year 6,000 Yah will commence, will actually conclude, on Sunday, October 2nd, with the arrival of Yom Kippurim and Sukkah. And that'll be the end of the 6,000 years of man, beginning a 7,000 year of camping out with God on this planet. And at the end of that, we begin eternity with God, creating a new universe with us as witnesses. So the story plays out over the course of sevens, the story of life. So this is Chaya, Shabbaim, life of 70 years. Even Shama here means time of renewal. The Hebrew word for years means time of renewal. And he fathered, and of course it's presented that way, Abram, fathered Yaled, impregnated his wife to conceive the descendants, Abraham. And Abraham means father who lifts up, increases, rises and grows. Father who enhances the capabilities and status, providing added aptitude, competency, and proficiency. Ab is the first half of it. Ab is the Hebrew word forefathers, the first word in every Hebrew dictionary. And Rum is the second half. So it's father, Rum. Rum means to uplift, to raise up, to promote growth, to lift up. Go ahead.
Every time I hear that, I think about two different things. One, obviously, when you're lifting up children, of course, and also lifting up man. But then, as you will discover later, about the real thing that he was talking about when he said, look at the lights. I mean, the increase of him.
Mm-hmm.
in another dimension. I mean, and that's played out in this thing real simply too. I mean,
the light, yes. The role of light and us being lifted up to become light. So here we have four names. Perak, which is, he's being used as, I'm going to share through this name that there are two messages which mankind must hear. And through this story, you're going to hear the two messages. Man's way and God's way. Teruah, which is the basis of Terak, is the embodiment of the two messages. The message of man and the message of God. They are opposites. And then it's all about life, chaya, staying alive. A plan that plays out, no matter how, if you're looking at the minute details or the big sweep of human history over the course of 7 days, 70 or 7,000. And then you have the three remaining names of the three sons. The one that matters, Abraham. Well, he was born as Abram. Abrum, father who lifts up. Then the other two, one just commentators didn't care, snored through it. And the other chose to rely on the high and mighty status afforded religion and politics. And therefore he was pulled down and destroyed.
Look him up, Aaron, and I can't find hardly anything good about him. And when you start going to the roots you're talking about, it describes everything that is Babylon.
Yes.
If you go to Haran, then it takes you to Har, which is just hilly mountain country. But then you go to, if you go where that phrase is used in Second Kings, is the mount of corruption, ruin, and destruction. Some of the verbs of Mashith and Shekaf, you know, to go to ruin, to pervert, to spoil. Place that I wrote in my commentary was to, you know, Babylon spoils the perfect plan. But HRS, Harath, is something broken into pieces. So every connection I could find with his name became totally adversarial to Yahweh.
Yeah, and names are important in this regard. And it's also important to know that while Haran, high and mighty, whose fortress is overthrown, pulled down, and destroyed, is a name that represents what ails humankind, religion and politics and militarism. And Nacor, which just simply means one who snores, represents a very large cross-section of people, and it's important to know that being oblivious isn't isn't going to play. We're going to work for you. Being naive, God's not going to accept the answer. But I didn't know. If only you had told me. What was he going to say? Did I not lay out my plan in the Torah? Is the Torah not the best preserved ancient book in human history? Aren't there like 10 billion copies of it?
In every motel room?
But isn't it free online in every manner of place? You know, there's 7 billion smartphones out there. Every single one of them you can read the Torah. I didn't know any better. Somebody had already told me. I was going to say, what do you want? Do you mean to tack it on your forehead?
Yeah, you have to participate.
Yeah, come on. Show some initiative.
Yeah, get off the couch.
No get worries. Off the couch. But I was lied to by my religious people. They said that it had all been replaced. That's Old Testament. The only thing that matters is the New Testament. So you want to tell me your excuse now is that you're so stupid, you can't figure out that a man who contradicted everything I said wasn't speaking for me?
Yeah.
How is it that you could be so stupid that you could believe the likes of Paul, who wrote half the Christian New Testament, or Muhammad, who dictated the entirety of the Islamic Quran, when they claimed that they were representing the God who revealed the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and yet they contradicted everything that I had said? And you're not smart enough to figure out that's not possible. You can't contradict everything the God who you claim has authorized you and inspired you says and be credible.
Yeah.
So if you're that stupid, you know, I didn't make you stupid. That's on you. I just don't want to be surrounded by stupid people. I've come to the conclusion, Kirk, that the single biggest weakness I thought I had, well, there's a lot of them, but the one that I thought would get me in the most trouble in doing radio was that I suffer fools poorly. And particularly when I did the shows like Shattering Myths, where we had all the callers with Scott, I figured that was going to get me in trouble, because when somebody calls up and they're a religious idiot, I just suffer fools poorly. I don't respond well to fools. Guess what I figured out?
Well, you never. Well, yeah, it was the set apart spirit kept you there.
Well, no, what I figured out is that God suffers fools more poorly than I do.
Yeah, yeah. He's quicker to say go away.
He's quicker to say go away. You're an idiot.
He did, yeah. If the story in the witness writings is, you know, he said, kick off the dust off your shoes and leave.
Yeah. Just. Go away. You're an idiot. You're bothering me. I'm disgusted by you. So, you know, that's God's position in all this. So it's important to know that. So this goes on to say, and so this is the perspective of the account of Terach. So this is the perspective is Ele, which is then this is the oath, as well as the curse, the promise of the covenant and the condemnation of the likes of Allah. Ele. This is the perspective. Remember, I told you, Teruah is good news, bad news.
Yeah.
God is really clear about this. And that's one of the things I think most people just don't get, either because they just haven't bothered to think about it. And a lot of times I'm criticized, Kirk, for being so condemning of religion and politics and patriotism and militarism and those kinds of things. So is God. The entire covenant message begins with a preamble of saying, here are the two choices. I'm laying out these two choices for you. Whether it's in Terach's name or it's in the first verb that is presented thereafter. He is saying, these are the two choices. There are, you know, there's a fork in the road. Is Yogi, he would say, if you find, come to a fork in the road, take it. This is the fork in the road.
Yeah.
You're either going to walk along with the vast preponderance of people through the muck and mire of religion and politics and patriotism and militarism. Or you're going to be like Nahor and you're just going to fall asleep and say, it's too big a decision for me. I'm pretty comfortable where I am. I'm just not going to go down either of these two roads. Or you're going to walk down a very unpopular road to the covenant. But there is no presentation of the covenant and life with God without a condemnation of the more popular path that men are on. Because you can't have both. It's a choice. Choose one or the other. You can't have both. And so constantly God will be laying out the alternative and explaining why the alternative is not acceptable and is actually in opposition to him. So this is the perspective.
Well, you know, this is the same as the three doors.
And yeah, it is. The three names, absolutely.
Yeah, the three names, and they correspond correctly. That one will take you to eternal damnation, eternal separation.
Right.
The other
one
will just, you'll just die.
Yeah, Haran will take you to Sheol.
Yeah.
Nahor will take you to oblivion.
You just squander everything.
Right. And Abram will take you to the covenant.
There.
Right. Yes, and the reason why we're talking about this, most people who have listened to these programs know that religion is wrong. All religions, when they say there's just, you know, socialist secular humanism, you're just nothing but random chance growth that has somehow spontaneously erupted on the scene, and you know, life is you live it and then you die and, you know, and that's it. But in terms of religion, religion is there's only heaven or hell. Every Christian will say you either go to heaven or hell. Same thing with every Muslim. That's 4 billion people today. They are wrong. 4 billion people, they're all wrong. In fact, if they were right, God would be wrong.
Yeah.
A God who would say, you know, love me, worship me, praise me, agree with me, or I'm going to see to it that you're eternally tortured in hell, would be sadistic. That kind of a God would not be worth knowing. You would not want to spend an eternity in the heaven of a God who says, love me, praise me, worship me, make donations to me, acquiesce to me, or I'm going to see to it that that you're tortured forever in hell. Such a God would not be lovable, and you would want nothing to do with him if you're a rational person.
Yeah. Can I share what I was going to send you?
Yeah, sure.
It's pretty close. You know, I was reading 10, preparing for this week, and it absolutely speaks to me. And then I was thinking about some things that you had said, and things, and I thought very... tried to think back when I had heard these things before when they disturbed me, and I wrote this note to you. Now let me just kind of read the note to you. I said, I wrote to you, Craig, and I said, throughout my life, I've heard this quite a few people tell me that God, usually they would say the Lord, spoke to me or called me out to do a certain work on his behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And they generally reference things like going on missions or some type of political action committee, and then also mostly preaching the gospel throughout the world.
Yeah, by the way, in 100% of these cases, they've actually chosen this, and now
now they won't go.
Now they want God's that's right. Yeah,
and
God never called them to do anything.
Yeah, when I hear those things, as I was in and out of Christianity,
uh-huh.
It usually would give me pause, of course, and quite frankly, I felt odd when I hear it, and often I didn't believe it at all. But when you say the other day, and you've done this, I mean, since I've read it all through your writings, when you say that about how Yahweh asked you to do this work, I didn't feel that way at all. And so I had to think about that. I was pondering it yesterday, trying to figure out why is that? Have I lost my edge or something?
Why
did it not bother me? And the reason to me was quite simple when I thought about it. Yahweh's call to action with you calls you to dedicate 16 years of your life so far, mm-hmm. exploring and translating the Torah, Navi, and Psalms
mm-hmm.
to an English-speaking world, translated from the original Hebrew language, mm-hmm. and helping others to do likewise.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about that. Well, that's absolutely true,
mm-hmm.
and that is profound because I can't think, Craig, and I think I wrote this down too, I can't think of any parallel in history, in recorded history, post Yosha, where that's happened. If this wasn't not a call from Yahweh, I said, in conclusion, I said, then please someone explain what spirit it was that talked to you. That's not a reaction that anybody takes. I can't find it anywhere. And the only thing I would think, I said, oh, what about Wycliffe and those? They all wanted to translate the Bible, but they failed. They didn't succeed at all. They didn't get it right. All they did was just translate from that.
All they did is translate the quote-unquote New Testament.
Yeah.
So half of what they wrote, what they conveyed, was Paul's rubbish translated from Greek into Latin and then to English. I mean, I don't care how many times you polish Paul's turds.
They're still
turds, man. No, Wycliffe didn't. Wycliffe suffered a lot, but no, what he did was had no value whatsoever.
Yeah. He didn't get it right, and he failed.
No, I mean, I can't say no value whatsoever. What he did was the first chip in the authoritarian rule of Roman Catholicism, because he proved that they were a bunch of scumbag liars. But if people paid attention to them, there wouldn't be, 2 billion Roman Catholics today.
Yeah. Well, the reason I was thinking about it, the reason I brought it up even, was because when you're reading this stuff, it's such a treasure that people are, in particular you, and some others that verify, like JB and so forth, and that here we have unequivocal proof of what Yahweh said.
Correct. And that's all we have. And that's all we have.
Right.
We've got nothing more than that.
He's God and all that. You can't. Mm-hmm. Come on. That's, you got to. You can't change that. But And still, there'll be very few.
You know, it's interesting, Kirk, on there's two parts I want to say that are interesting on this. One is that in all of this, I have never once claimed personal, unique, proprietary revelation. Never once said that God spoke to me as in a dream or in a vision, and never once have I conveyed anything that wasn't available to everyone. Every word that I have translated and shared based upon what Yahweh conveyed to us is available to everyone on earth.
Yeah.
So I didn't never once claimed anything unique.
It's come out of the blue for you.
No, just here is what he said. Now, the only thing that goes beyond here's what he said in an amplified translation is that when you read and think about what he said and you study what he said, you learn.
Yeah.
And when you learn, you're able to derive insights and understanding from those words. And so I will share the insights and understanding that I have gleaned by translating and studying and closely examining, carefully considering those words.
Yeah. And it'll stand the test of time. I mean, if you know what you studied, yeah, that's exactly what you said. It verifies it here, and it verifies it again, and again, and again, and again, and again. So, and every time, like you say, every time you go back and translate, even a little bit I do, I can absolutely guarantee you, you go back three times and you'll find a little something else. A little gleaning here and a little gleaning there. And it just reinforces.
One of the most profound conclusions, Kirk, that I came to, the single most provocative conclusion that I came to, beyond the fact that the Christian New Testament's rubbish. Christianity is a religion of lies. Islam is religion for stupid people. Muhammad was the most perverted man who ever lived. He most certainly didn't speak for God. Paul was scum, is the plague of death. But there's something that I came to realize that is far more controversial and far more fundamental and far more profound than anything else. And I've seen it now materialize before my eyes, and as I'm translating Yeshaya 14 for the 21st chapter of Observations for Our Time. And seeing it just this black and white, it's really stopped me. I've had a more difficulty, Kirk, writing the commentary for this chapter than anything else, because it reemphasizes what you've just said.
Mm-hmm.
That all I've done is translate what God said and helped explain it as it has been explained to me.
Yeah.
So here I have said something for a long time. I've said that the God of Christianity, the God of Islam, the Lord God of Christianity, the God of Islam, the God of Hashem of Rabbinic Judaism, is Satan.
Yeah.
He's Satan. That is, I'm telling you, folks, that is a fact. The God that men and women worship in Christianity, Islam, and Judaism is all the same. That part man got right. He's Satan. Without exception, he is Satan. The Christian God is Satan. The Islamic God is Satan. The God of Judaism is Satan. And as I read and translated Yeshaya 14, which was really the whole purpose of this book, right from the, as I started writing it on Proverbs 6, and it was a declaration against Christianity. And I decided, you know, right then and there, I needed to carry this through with the beginning of Yeshaya Isaiah all the way through the 14th chapter, because I think that God's going to be extraordinarily blunt and clear about Satan's role in all of this that was suggested in the sixth proverb. And you know what I came across, Kirk, that was stunning to me? You know how many times I've said that, you know, that Satan claims in Yeshaya 14 that he wants to be above God?
Right.
It's not what it says. It's not what it says. It says he wants to be God. He says he wants to be known
as God.
Yeah. That his whole mentality will be to be known as God through intermixing and through confusion. And when you read that, then you
say,
so this is Yahweh telling us that there's no question that Satan doesn't want to be worshipped as the adversary. The big answer for me as I was writing Prophet of Doom was, you know, how in the world could the Quran condemn Satan if Allah was Satan? And I figured it out. I said, well, the reason is because Satan doesn't want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be known as God. I always thought it was just hinted at, that it was one of those things that if you studied long enough, hard enough, it was an inescapable conclusion that you would form, is that the god of religion is Satan. But what happens, Kirk, when it's just plainly laid out right before your eyes, and God says exactly that, and then you realize that not only I, but the whole world has had access to this for thousands of years, 2,700 years on Yahshayah, and they paid no attention to it.
Yeah, they're without excuse.
Oh, man. You know, so you come to it, and you know how I'm always want to say, well, this is what this means, this is what it affirms, this is how it relates to other things. Well, you see something that profound affirmed, you almost don't know what to say.
Yeah. Well, let him say it.
I don't have any words to add to it.
You just say ditto.
Profound. I was going to say the other thing I wanted to convey. So, first of all, yes, I was called to do this. And by called, I was asked. And yet in asking... there are two things that are important. One is that I'm not a prophet. He didn't say, I want to reveal my testimony through you. No. No, I want you to share what I have said. I want you to share the truth. Just convey what I've said. So I'm just simply translating and then teaching what Yahweh has already said through his prophets and psalms. There's nothing more that needs to be said. The second is that that if God's going to pick somebody to work with, you need to know that person's got flaws. God doesn't pick perfect people. He never picks people that man would view as qualified.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a honor. You know, you've got to have your quirks or you ain't going
to
be picked.
Seminary, did he?
No, he did not. He did not rifle through the theologians or the politicians or those that were, stunningly rich that could, broadcast the message to the world. But yet he did pick somebody who had not only made enough money that he didn't have to work anymore and he could donate 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, for now 16 years doing this, but it also had been so crucified publicly, wrongly, mind you, about business that just didn't care anymore. I didn't care what people said about them. And I just don't care. I mean, you could Google my name and you could find hundreds of thousands of articles and comments that are derogatory.
Really?
I don't care. Don't care. I won't even bother to read them. Won't defend myself. I do not. Just genuinely do not care. And you've got to be in that position. Otherwise, you can't do this. Now, the other thing I was going to say, this is the second point. It didn't begin with Christianity. Just as this message begins with a man's name that says there's two options here, man's way and God's way. Just as this begins with saying, so this is the perspective on the oath and also of the curse. For me to come to know the God who asked me to work with him on this project, I had to know what God opposed. I had to know what wasn't God.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't begin in the Torah. I began in the Quran. I came to learn who God is not. Who the adversary is, how the adversary works through religion and politics and militarism. And it was only then that I was prepared to go and learn the things of God. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we all have to come from that point. We've got to first recognize that man's way is wrong. Religion is wrong. Politics is wrong. Patriotism is wrong. Militarism is wrong. All the things that man reveres are wrong. And until you know that stuff, you're not prepared to know the things of God. So, that's all part of it. And I think it was pretty upfront, Kirk, when I was originally asked to do this, mm-hmm. I didn't know who I was talking to. And he introduced himself as God. I didn't know his name. Mm-hmm. Didn't know anything about him. In fact, you know, I was an agnostic at that point in time. I had left Christianity.
Yeah.
I was like Abraham. No, Abraham had been plugged in to religion and politics and patriotism and militarism and then the Pharaoh's household in Egypt. And then he witnessed what that power was doing to people, how it was enslaving them and abusing them. And it bothered him to the point that he killed a taskmaster that was abusing an innocent person. And then he fled. He left it all. And so while he was raised to be religious and political and militaristic and patriotic, he left all those things. Mm-hmm. Moses did. Moshe. Okay. And so you realize that is the kind of thing that God's looking for. He's looking for the person who has knowledge of these things and has left them. Do you think that Abraham was a neophyte when it came to politics and religion and government and patriotism and militarism? Living in Ur of Sumah, and Sumah was incorporated into Babylon?
Yeah. No, he saw it right there.
Oh, of course. It was the most religious and political, militaristic place on earth at the time.
Yeah. How could you not?
Right. And so for God's way to be appealing, for it to register, you have to understand this fork in the road. You know, it's one way or the other. All paths do not lead to God. Almost all paths lead away from him. There's only one path that leads to him. And you need to know why man's way isn't the right way. So, yes, Kirk, you know, you're right. The moment somebody says that God called them to do something, you ought to run. It ought to cause you to say, this person's an idiot. They're claiming things which aren't true.
That's a preacher?
Yeah.
The old Presbyterian preacher, he gets mm-hmm. from a small town, he gets an offer to go work at a great big church in, let's say, Atlanta.
Yeah.
And he comes home, tells his wife, and he says, you know, they're going to pay me $100,000, and I don't know, but I got to think about this. And so he goes into his study to pray, and his wife says, hallelujah, runs upstairs and starts packing.
So this is the perspective of the account. This is Toledoth of the written genealogical record regarding the descendants, the history, the origins, and the result of Terach. God wants you to know the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Toledoth of Terach, the living embodiment of the two messages, proclaiming the joyous news of God's beneficial healing while rebuking man's fraudulent treachery and deceit. Terach fathered, conceived the descendants. Abram, father who lifts up. Nahor, one who sleeps. And Haran, the high and mighty who is pulled down. And Haran fathered Lot.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, one who is shrouded, blocking any association with the light.
What a name, huh?
You know, it's interesting with Lot is that a lot of people say, well, you know, Lot's symbolic of the Christian rapture. You know, how that one godly man was plucked out of Sodom. Bull.
He brought most of Sodom with him.
Bull. Yeah. His wife longed for the place. His daughters were perverted. And in his response, when he met with the two men, teenagers, saying, "Hey, no, leave them alone. You can go and rape my my daughters."
Yeah.
No.
What a sicko, huh?
He's a sicko. He is one who is shrouded, blocking any association with the light. He was spared for only one reason, and one reason alone.
Abraham.
Hey, you betcha. That's it. He was Abraham's nephew, and Yahweh said,
"He said, okay,
I'll do it for you.
Take care of it.
Yeah, I'll do it for you. Yeah, he's going to die anyway, and he's going to have a miserable life. But you know, I'll send a couple of Malak down there. They'll take care of it for you."
Nice guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, really. Think about
right.
This. Yeah, think about that. Gosh.
Yeah. But the person for Lot being here is the children of those who are plugged into society, the children of the high and mighty.
Yeah.
They're destined for a miserable life. They'll never come to know God. That's why when God was said, you know, they corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation. So Lot, following his father's footsteps, went the wrong direction and chose to live in Sodom. And while he was spared before it was destroyed, he offered his daughter's virginity to the Moloch who had come to rescue him. Then on his way out of town, Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt for ignoring Yahweh's instructions and looking back, thereby demonstrating her continued affinity for the ills of human society. This led to an episode of incest with his daughter, suggesting that Lot's thinking was indeed shrouded in darkness. Now, should you be curious, salt was used as currency back in the day because of its ability to keep food from rotting as a result. In Ezra 4:14, it was presented as a form of payment and is thereby symbolically showing that Lot's wife was subject to decay as a result of being beholden to the interests of Sodom, and thus Satan. She had turned her back on the initial step of Yahweh's means to salvation, and would thus not be allowed into the promised land.
Now,
can I just return to one thing, and then I want to hear what you have to say, because you brought this up, being called by Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
To be asked by Yahweh to engage in a project with him, does a person no good whatsoever unless they choose of their own volition to walk down that path, to go where his words lead, to never turn back. Now, there's not a lot of people that are going to be willing to do that, because his path leads away from everything man reveres.
It does.
But God's invitation does you no good whatsoever unless you're willing to walk down the path that his words guide you and never turn back.
Yeah. Very good. Well said. Exactly.
We were going to comment, or were we going to go to the next statement here?
No, I was just going to say that was a terrific insight. I mean, about the decay and the way subject to decay. That's cool.
You know, one of the things that's really important here, and by the way, that is the essence of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
All wisdom is making the connections which lead to understanding. And there's a lot to it. You know, part of wisdom is a filter. So you know what to filter out and that is rubbish, and what to embrace is true. And then making connections with things so that you come to understand what is being said, not just know it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, those things are important to the process. And we have marvelous brains that God gave us, and the Salma, which is our conscience, that helps us reason through this process. And so all of it is really important to understanding. So then Haran, the high and mighty whose fortress is overthrown, pulled down and destroyed, perished. But by the way, before I go on, let's say one other thing that strikes me about this. There is something that most people miss when listening to the stories that Yahweh tells in his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And that is that there's constantly, fact, more times than not, God conveys stories about people, places, and discussions which show people being wrong, doing the wrong thing. You know, just because you read it there does not mean that we ought to do it. There's things that Dode did, things that Daniel did, things that Moshe did that they ought not have done. But God's not trying to work with perfect people, but instead convey a message to flawed people and to perfect those flawed people. And therefore, we are shown as we are, the good, bad, and the ugly. And so there's lots of places you're going to read stories about, you know, Haran was not a good guy. Lot was not a good guy. God presents these stories because he's real.
Yeah. They're really symbolic. So I mean,
yeah.
You jump on the story, and it just deeper and deeper.
Right. Right. And part of it, too, is always keep this in mind. God is not the least bit interested in saving everyone. God most assuredly does not love everyone.
No. Well, he tells you over and over, if you don't care for what I care for, you don't like me.
Right.
Well, I have no interest in you.
Right.
Why would you?
Right. Why would you?
I mean, he's not missing anything.
Yeah. Now, it's one thing for God to say, that he would wish for none to perish and all to enjoy eternal life. Huh. He can wish that to be the case. But it doesn't mean that he's trying to save everybody. He's not.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that he loves everybody. Yeah, it's, he despises about 99.999% of humanity. And by the way, when he returns, that's quite one of the reasons it's really tough when you get deep into Yahshua and he's talking about his return in the last days. It gets really tough sometimes.
To read it,
to read it, because he is obliterating humankind.
Yeah.
Obliterating humankind. Every trace of religion and politics and patriotism and militarism is being completely annihilated, turned to goo, liquefied.
Mm.
All of it. There'll be so few people left that he loves and supports, he says that a child will be able to count them.
Wow.
So, I mean, keep in mind that is his perspective. And don't just think, well, you know, I know God loves me. I know that he knows my heart. He knows where I'm going. This, that, the other.
No.
Stop it.
He tells you what you have to do to be part of his family. If you can't find yourself in that, then you don't have any hope yet.
That is correct. So then Haran, in the presence of Terach, his father, in the country of his relatives and with whom he identified politically and religiously. I love that. Moledith. Of his birth, with a focus on the customs and culture of the people who conceived him and with whom he would show an affinity of his society and community. So, Haran perished in the presence of Terach, his father. Haran, the high and mighty, in the country of his relatives and with whom he identified politically and religiously, in Ur. It's amazing that, you see things like in Ur, you realize that this was written 3,450 years ago. 3,450 years ago is when this was written. And here's a phonetic language that transliterates the name of the city of Suma, which became part of Babylon, as Ur. When the brightest archaeologists didn't come to know the pronunciation of that name until quite recently, and yet here it has always been.
That is amazing.